Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Coming up on episode 240 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the Lucid Air, the Nissan Ariya, Honda Passport, Volvo XC40 Recharge, the Lotus Eletre, Stellantis' new Hurricane engine, the Mazda CX-50, and a whole bunch of questions. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. This is episode 240 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abruel Sandwich from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from Wired.
And Nicole is in transit right now from an airplane to a hotel in Encinitas. And she will be joining us, hopefully in progress, sometime before we're finished saying all the stuff that we're going to say.
I hope so. She slides in with like breaking news. She's like, I'm just in, guys.
Maybe she'll spill some embargoed information about the Toyota BZ4X, which I drove yesterday.
Dun, dun, dun.
And we'll be talking more about that in probably two weeks from now. And we've got a whole bunch of embargoed drive impressions coming up. It's like right now, this past 2 weeks, it seems like at least a dozen automakers were doing various drive programs all on top of each other, and you know, all with various embargo dates.
Yeah, I've been to... Oh, I should talk about the Ariya this week. Yeah, I went to...
Oh, okay.
I should write down things I'm going to talk about. But yeah, it's been a crazy past few weeks, and I still got two more weeks of insane travel with embargoed cars and events and drives. And I think, you know, the Omicron, whatever.
Yes. Omicron. Like everybody paused for a couple of months during Omicron, and now they're trying to get everything in before the end of the quarter.
Yeah, they're just packing everything in. So there's that, and during any week, there's up to like five programs. You're just like, I can't. And everyone's like, hey, can you go to our program? Can you go to our program? I'm like, I can't go to every program.
Yeah,
like, I'm sorry. Please,
I know,
spread them
I've
out.
I've had to pass on a couple of them as well.
Please spread them out.
Yeah.
May All and right. June are just ripe for. There's just like one or two programs there. Throw some over there.
Yeah.
Toss a couple in there.
Well, there's more going to be more stuff coming in May and June too. The F-150 Lightning we're going to get to drive in first week of May, and then after that the Cadillac Lyric. And
something's happening in June.
Well, Lyric is probably going to be either later in June or early July. They said early summer. Right. They started production last week officially.
Yeah, I saw that. Nice.
And so sometime late spring, early summer, they'll do the drive, but. Right now, we've got stuff we can talk about. We can't talk about those yet because they haven't happened. But what did you drive?
So it's been I feel like it's been a few weeks since I've been on the podcast because I think I was out 1 week.
And then there was the crazy bits and pieces episode.
Yeah, then there was a week of like, because everyone was out. So so I've driven a bunch of cars, but I'm going to talk about two. And one of them is the Lucid Air Dream Edition Performance. This is the 1,111 horsepower insane Lucid Air. It is a very nice car. I drove it around the Bay Area. I had it for about a week or so, I believe. And yeah, it's really nice inside. It's comfortable. I know that there was this desire to build a vehicle that rivals the luxury vehicles of Germany. They were just going right after the German sedan. That's the thing. They're taking aim at BMW, Mercedes, and Audi. And I think for the most part, in their own way, I think they've accomplished that. I think they're the I think when you look at, like, say, the EQS, which is probably its closest competitor, the EQS has a lot more bells and whistles that are going on in the vehicle as while you're in there.
Well, it has that hyperscreen.
Yeah, and it has the hyperscreen. I think the Lucid is it's focusing on Germany, but taking a lot of pages out of the Swedish design philosophy of sort of less is more. Mm-hmm. There are, if you get into the infotainment system, there's a lot of things you can adjust with that car. There's just a ton of settings. It's, you know, so you're not like sort of, you know, kept from the vehicle. You're still a lot you can do, but on the surface, it's very nice. It's very clean, and it's very, very fast.
I can attest to that.
Yeah,
I had a chance to drive one briefly as well.
So just like tapping on the accelerator, it's like wow. And so you don't get the 1,111 horsepower until you put it in sprint mode, and then you put it in launch control. The problem is that, and I think we've seen this recently with someone doing that on a Tesla on a hill because they're idiots, mm-hmm. and those people shouldn't be allowed to drive ever. And then all the people standing around just like letting that happen, like no one said, hey, maybe don't. So the issue with that is trying to find a location in order to test that. So there's a place, there's a few places near my house where I can, but I have to wait till night. So I end up finally testing it at night on a slight uphill. So... and it was still, it was sort of ridiculous. And a little bear pops up, a little blue bear, because yep. they're, you know, out of California. And so that was, enjoyed
that. That is their Easter egg that they have kind of all over the car.
Yeah, there's, the little bear.
Little bears.
Yeah, so it's a great car. Lucid, and I think Lucid and Rivian were the two companies that I really see, it really seemed like they were going to make it. They were going to... Of all the automotive startups, sorry, I've been running around all day. Those were the two that I thought would produce something, have something out, and then have it available for purchase. And they've both done that. Of course, Rivian's hitting problems with supply issues, and you know everyone's having these supply issues. So we'll see what happens. It seems kind of unfair that these two companies that seem to be doing mostly everything correctly are now being sort of punished. Or having these difficulties because of this very weird situation where even, you know, folks, everyone's having problems with this. But when you're a small company and you're making one car, you can't like sort of spread out the hurt on a bunch of different vehicles. You're just sort of hurt. So we'll see. So, drove it around. The Range Edition has 520 miles of range, which... I mean, Tesla for years has been sort of the king of range, and now Lucid comes along and says, no, that's cool. I mean, and it helps that, like, most of the Lucid engineers are former Tesla engineers, and Peter...
Including their CEO.
who is the man who made the Model S work, literally. So the Performance Edition has a range of 471 miles. I had the 21-inch wheels, so it had a range of 450-ish. During my range run... I had a little bit north of 400 miles, so I didn't quite hit the 451. The problem is that I got a little. There's back roads on my 100 mile loop that I use for EVs, and I kind of went a little fast on the back roads. Which, you know, it's not the cardinal. But again, it's beating Tesla, not just because, they're very efficient, but it's also got a 118 kilowatt hour battery, where Tesla's is 100 kilowatts. Kilowatt hours. So it has more range than Tesla, but it also has a larger battery. They've been working really hard over there to fix their efficiency. And if you don't have $169,000 for the Dream Edition, don't worry, because A, it's sold out. Eventually they will have the Pure Edition, which is... Hold on, I'm going to find the price. I believe it's
78 and change.
Yeah, $78,000, and it has 406 miles of range. So still a lot of range, under $100,000 for a competitor to the luxury market Far more luxurious than, say, a Model S. I think I called the Model S luxury adjacent.
Last week, as we record this, the week before, I was invited to interview Peter Rawlinson, the CEO of Lucid, and he's also the CTO and the aforementioned former chief engineer of the Model S, on stage at South by Southwest. And one of the topics we talked about was efficiency, and their real focus on efficiency in this thing. He did tell me that the Pure will be going into production this fall, so it'll be available before the end of this year. But you were talking about supply chain problems, and Rivian having difficulty building cars and building trucks and delivering them. And Peter said the same thing. There's a few key components that they're having a hard time getting enough of to ramp up their production, which is a real challenge. And because they are a smaller automaker, when you've got automakers that are buying parts for hundreds of thousands or millions of vehicles, and you're looking to buy parts for thousands to tens of thousands of vehicles a year, the company that is buying parts for millions is going to get priority. They're going to be first in line for those parts. And so, they've been working to, in some cases, resource some of those parts, so they can get their production ramped up. I think they've delivered about 500 Airs so far. They're looking to get that up, into about 30,000 a year from their current production capacity at their factory in Arizona. I have a question for you, though. Before I did the interview, I had the opportunity to take an Air Dream Edition performance out for about an hour or so for a drive. I had first seen this thing back in November 2016 when Peter and Derek Jenkins, their head of design, were at the LA Auto Show. They weren't publicly displaying anything, but they were doing some background briefings. And so we spent about an hour and a half back then going through all the things they were doing. And, then they did a VR walk, design walk around. And then we went down in the garage and saw the first prototype that they had down there. One of the things, was interesting about this design, is that you mentioned you're targeting Mercedes. On the outside, this thing has about the physical footprint of a Mercedes E-Class. But on the inside, it has the passenger volume of an S-Class, which is a considerably larger car. And one of the things I noticed getting into this one, especially into the driver's seat, the front pillars are really sloped back. Mm-hmm. There's a very aggressive slope on those. And I had to duck quite a bit to get my head under there and get into the car. And you're several inches taller than I am. How was it for you getting in and out of this thing?
I don't remember any real issues getting in and out of it, actually. I mean, I'm used to driving. I mean, I drive a BRZ.
Yeah.
So I'm used to just like taking this very large body and squishing it down really small.
Yeah.
And then getting into something. So I don't remember any like hitting my head or anything. I do know that even with the seat set for me at 6'3", I could get in the back seat and still have lots of room. Yeah. And that rear door opens at a 90-degree angle, so it's super easy to get in and out of that that rear seat. So if you're being driven around, there's a lot of room back there, and it's way easy to get in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is very true. This is a stunning looking car, and when you get in it, it feels like a luxury car. It doesn't feel ostentatious, but it feels very, very premium, much more so than any Tesla ever has.
Oh yeah, it's very, it's classy.
Yeah,
it's very classy. Everything about it just feels very nice. It doesn't feel minimalistic for the sake of like saving money. It feels more like this is a design This is a design decision for the entire car, but you're still going to have a lot of information if you need it, and if you're the kind of person who wants to like adjust every single teeny tiny thing on the car, you can.
And I like that they have tried to find a good balance between touch controls and physical controls. So, you know, there's a row of switches. There's that screen in the center console. So you've got the large screen across the top of the dash. You know, there's actually three displays in there, that spans from the A-pillar on the driver's side over across the middle of the dashboard. And then down below in the center stack, there's another touch screen down there, which you can actually tap, and it, I think you showed it in your video, you know, it actually will pull up into the dashboard, so it's out of the way if you're not using it. But above that, you know, just below the vents, there's a row of switches for the climate control. So, you know, it's always there. You don't have to mess around with digging through menus to find your climate controls. They're always accessible.
Climate control buttons to me and volume buttons are the things that I feel like should continue to be physical buttons, because I think people are like, well, I just send it to like this temperature. I'm like, I am always adjusting the climate controls and I'm always adjusting the audio, the you know, how loud things are. Those having those available as actual physical buttons where I can just reach over and use them instead of like, oh, let me use my finger and do this. And yeah, it's a much nicer experience as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. All right. So what else did you drive?
I went all the way to Spain, España, and I drove the Nissan Ariya on a track.
So you went to Spain to drive a new Japanese EV.
I went to Spain to drive a Japanese EV on a track, not on a road. These are pre-production vehicles. I'm sure there's a lot of reasons why it happened in Spain. It doesn't really matter. I drove the Nissan Ariya on a track in Spain. What they did, it wasn't like they didn't set up the track, so it's, you know, this vehicle is not a it's not a Model Y performance. Nissan was very said this is not a missile. This is not a, you know, this is a nice SUV. And I'm going to tell you,
it's mainstream.
Yes, it is really nice inside that car. I think they took a lot of time and care to make sure that it differentiates itself from the rest of that sort of market of the midsize SUV with an interior that's really, really nice. They have this little lantern. They have a lot of there's like almost like crosshatch, like little triangles. Mm-hmm. That are integrated into the design, and they are inspired by Japanese lanterns. In fact, they're like in the footwell, in the middle is like a little, you know, it's a square with that sort of triangle design, that tight triangle design. It looks like a little lantern in the car. And so there's all these like, it's very, yeah, I was really impressed, because for the most part, Nissan interiors are sort of like, well, there it is. That's what it is, you know. And I think they really, when it comes to that, they really said, you know what, we need to have something, because they're not, I hate saying people are late to the EV world, because it's, again, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. Everyone's going to have an EV, and right now we're still
arguably Nissan was first.
Yeah, they had the Leaf,
with a volume EV.
Yeah, they had the number one selling EV in the world for a very long time, mm-hmm. and then they didn't make anything else.
At least nothing that they brought to North America.
Exactly. And it's actually a really nice car. I drove it around the track. It drives well. It's, you know, it's hard to like really judge how well it does, you know, when you're on a track that's like, here's some cones to recreate what it's like to drive in a city, and here's a cone, like, you know, to, here's a chicane, and here's what a roundabout would be like. And it's like, okay. And so I drove it around this track a ton of times. It handles pretty well. They didn't have an Ariya with their new e-Force with an F. The F has been replaced by a 4. Nissan e-Force, their all-wheel drive system. They did let us drive a Nissan Leaf that had this system. And it was interesting because the way the system works, it's not, you know, everyone has, at this point, everyone has some sort of all-wheel drive system. But this one, like, the way it balances out the car was very interesting. Like, there's not a lot of diving when you when you slow down as you would have in a regular all-wheel drive vehicle. It's something that you almost have to, and I hate to say this.
So they're adjusting the torque on the front and rear motors.
Yeah,
to minimize the weight transfer.
Yeah, and it's the same motors on the front and the back. So typically you have a much more powerful motor on the back and then a less powerful motor on the front. They're going to use the same size, the same power motors, both front and back on the vehicle, which is interesting. And they're like, yeah, it'll be a 50-50, power balance. And you're just like, oh, okay. And so it's very interesting. It'll be interesting to see what it's like on the actual Aria and then what it's like on the road. But it was like a really good appetizer of what's to come from them. And I went over there not knowing what to expect. I mean, I know a lot of people really love the Nissan Leaf. Nissan Leaf's a good car. I just find it incredibly boring. And yeah. I think that I don't think they were listening to me, but I think they might have known that they need something. A little something extra to sort of break out of that mold, to break out of the Leaf and have something that people are going to look at and be like, oh, maybe I should get a Nissan EV. And I think they're definitely on the right track. So kudos to Nissan for that.
Good. I'm looking forward to driving it later this year. You know, it's launching in Japan this summer and then going on sale in North America in the fall. So hopefully by the end of the year, those will be available to customers here in the U.S.
Yeah, they told me that two-wheel drive version will be available in early fall, and then the e-Force all-wheel drive version would be available in late fall.
Okay. And I think that they're launching only with the extended range battery, which is going to be somewhere around 300-mile range.
Yeah.
And then they'll launch the standard range version, which is going to be around 230, 240 miles sometime early next year. And that's the one that'll start around $40,000. The others start around 46, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So it's still, it's right up there with like the IONIQ 5, EV6. How much is the Pulse? You just drove it. Here, we'll just ask you. The XC40.
The XC40 is, or the C40, I should say. Is 60,000. It's like 59,000 including delivery.
All right.
I think it's a bit smaller than the Aria,
but it's also crazy fast.
Yes, it is.
Those things are so fast. All of us. The XC40 and the C40 are so like they're just like wow.
They're surprising when you step on it. You know, how quick they go.
They're just like we have the system from the Polestar 2. We just threw it in here. Go for it. Knock yourself out. You're like okay.
Yeah. And. For those that are, not quite ready to make the jump to a full battery electric vehicle, if you're not quite confident that it's going to meet your needs, we also have plug-in hybrids that are available. And one of those, actually Kia's got several of them now, but one of those is the Sorento plug-in hybrid, which was added to the new generation Sorento lineup, which launched in late 2020. The plug-in hybrid was added last year. And this is, it's using the same basic hybrid architecture that Hyundai Motor Group has been using for the past decade. So it's a little different from the way Toyota does it. You know, Toyota's systems, their hybrid drive has two electric motors in there that they use for balancing or for doing the regenerative braking and also for grounding the planetary gear set. And it essentially gives you an electronic continuously variable transmission system with those.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Motors and the gears that they have in there. Hyundai Motor Group, which includes Hyundai, Kia, and Genesis, does a different approach, which is more similar to what you find, from a bunch of other automakers, including Volkswagen, where the The motor goes in place of where the torque converter would be on a conventional automatic transmission. So it's between the engine and the transmission. No torque converter. And then there's clutches on either side of the motor. And a conventional six-speed automatic gearbox. And in the case of a lot of the previous hybrids and plug-in hybrids from Hyundai and Kia have used a naturally aspirated 2-liter four-cylinder with that combination. For the Sorento, which is a bit bigger than some of the previous ones, they have swapped in a version of the 1.6-liter turbo, direct-injected turbo, that is widely used across both of those brands' vehicle lineups. In this case, it generates 177 horsepower and 195 foot-pounds of torque, so it's got really good broad torque band. And then they add in a 90 horsepower electric motor in there, and the total the motor itself has 224 foot-pounds of torque from zero RPM. So you get a combined total when they're all blended together of 261 horsepower and 258 foot-pounds of torque, which is pretty good. You know, it's comparable to what you would get with a V6 in many crossovers of this size. And the overall performance is more than adequate. It's quite quick. They have the same basic setup with the hybrid and the plug-in hybrid, the main difference being the battery size. The plug-in hybrid gets a 14 kilowatt hour battery pack, which gives you an EPA rated range estimate of 34 miles. When I was driving it, 32 miles. When I was driving it, I went through my usual drive loop that I do with plug-in vehicles, and I actually got it to go 34 miles before the engine kicked on. With the amount of power, and particularly the amount of torque that this electric motor has, it's pretty easy to drive it on electricity alone. You don't have to, be really light-footed on it. You can engage an EV-only mode. The power, the 90 horsepower is not a huge amount, but the 224 foot-pounds of torque is more than enough for your daily driving. So the Sorento, is a sort of upper mid-size crossover. It's got a third row of seats. Trust me, you don't really want to use them. Just fold them down, have a big giant cargo space in the back, because unless you've got a couple of passengers back there with, that have been amputated at the knees, they really don't want to sit back there. With the rear seats folded down, the third row seats folded down, you get lots of cargo space. It's a decent size. It's nice and roomy. It's smaller than a Telluride, bigger than a Sportage, or Sportage as some people like to pronounce it.
Sportage.
For the plug-in hybrid variant, which unfortunately Hyundai and Kia, because they are supply constrained on the batteries, they only offer the plug-in hybrid versions of their vehicles in California and the other dozen or so states that mandate manufacturers have to sell a certain percentage of EVs. For example, if you live here in Michigan, you can't go to a Kia dealer here and buy one. You would have to go to a Kia dealer in, California or Colorado or somewhere in the Northeast and buy one and bring it back and then transfer the registration to Michigan. That said, if you do want one, the starting price is $46,000 and change. For the SX, 45,190, and then with the $1,300 destination fee, you're a little over 46,000. And then there's also the SX Prestige, which adds a few more options for another couple of thousand dollars. The one that I drove was an SX Prestige, pretty much loaded with everything, leather interior, you know, the Bose premium audio system, 12.3-inch digital instrument cluster, perforated leather seats, you know, they're heated and cooled, all that good stuff. Came to a grand total of $49,720, including the delivery fee. It's, as I said, you know, it's rated at 32 miles of electric driving range by the EPA, 79 mpge for combined driving, a typical combined driving cycle. And if you drive it without plugging it in and just use it as a regular hybrid, you'll get about 34 miles per gallon, which is, you know, comparable to what you would get with something like the Toyota Highlander, which is just slightly larger. I think the driving experience in this one, because it uses a conventional, you know, step ratio automatic transmission, the driving experience feels better in this one. It feels more natural. You never get any of that motorboating effect that you get with a CVT type of system. And it feels nice to drive. It's got a nice interior. It's got sounds of nature. It looks good.
I love the sound. Or Parisian coffee house.
Yeah. Whatever, you know, walking through the woods, a Parisian coffee house, you know, whatever.
Snow, walking through the snow.
Yeah. Stream, babbling stream, you know, whatever turns you on, you know, it's all there. That is, continues to be a feature that is unique to Hyundai and Kia vehicles only. If you appreciate that sort of thing, you know, Kia's got you covered with the Sorento plug-in hybrid. At the Chicago Auto Show, they announced the Sportage plug-in hybrid, which will have the same powertrain in it. And that's coming, I think, later this summer. So there's, you know, there's increasing number of options for people that want to go either fully or partially electric, you know, with a family-oriented vehicle. Last time that we got together, I talked about the Kia Carnival, which did not get anywhere near as good fuel economy as this thing does. And I would be shocked if before too long Kia doesn't drop this same powertrain into the Carnival, because I think this would be a really good combination in the Carnival. You know, it's got similar overall performance, similar overall power to the V6 in the Carnival, and would get vastly better fuel economy and, you know, give you, you know, 30 plus miles of electric driving, which for most people means that you can, you know, if you plug it in at night, you can do almost all of your daily driving without ever using any gas. You know, you might only go, you know, go to the gas station, you know, every few months, which when gas is, you know, upwards of $6 a gallon as it is in California right now, I'm sure that would not bother you in the least.
It would, you know, you should be, yeah.
All right, let's move on to some other stories of the week. Let's start with the Lotus Eletre.
Eletre.
Yes, I would be curious to see what Colin Chapman would think of this thing.
I mean, I think there's it's an SUV. Let's just say that. So, and, you know, people got mad at Porsche when they put out an SUV. People got mad at Lamborghini because they put out an SUV. But you know what? SUVs, they pay the bills.
That's right.
SUVs pay the bills because people want SUVs.
Selling Cayennes and Macans is what allows Porsche to continue selling 911s and Boxsters.
The fact that there is a 911, there is a variant of 911 for every single person who's bought a 911.
Yeah.
It's because of all the Macans and the Cayennes out there. And the Urus is the best-selling Lamborghini ever made. That's just hands down. It's just like, just money. It's just it's printing money for Lamborghini. And so they can make all the Huracans and Aventadors and whatnot.
Or even restart the Aventador assembly line. You know,
yeah, because a bunch of them
build 12 more final edition cars.
12 more. You're the guy's like taking it apart
at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean.
Yep. You're the guy who took it apart is just like, ah, are you kidding me? Okay.
So the Electra, in typical Lotus fashion, the name's got to start with an E, and they had to kind of make it sound sort of electric. Although the name apparently has a meaning, which I can't find right now. But it says it's got the release. The bullet points at the top of the press release say the soul of a Lotus with the usability of an SUV. But when I first looked at the photo of this, the photos of this thing, the first thing that actually came to mind, looking at the front, was that Lamborghini Urus that you mentioned. To me, there's a lot of Urus in that front end.
Yeah, there is. The back end though is very, very reminiscent of the Evija, the hypercar, the Evija, 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 whatever.
Yeah.
They're a British company. I don't know what's going on. the Evija. And so the back end is very much, based on that design that they showed off. But the front end, yeah. It's a little Lamborghini-esque.
Yeah. So this thing's got two electric motors with somewhere upwards of 600 horsepower, 100-plus kilowatt-hour battery pack, top speed of 161 miles an hour, 0 to 60 in sub-3 seconds, and a range on the WLTP drive cycle, which is the one they use in Europe, of 373 miles. So that should... On EPA, it should put it, a little over 300, probably around 310, maybe 315 on the EPA test, which is pretty good.
That's good. 800 volt system, I think. I know it says 350 kilowatt charging capability, so 800 volt, which I don't know why anyone's on why everyone's on 800 volt at this point, but sure.
It does add cost. There is a cost associated with the components you need to do an 800 volt.
If Hyundai can do it,
that's true.
Then I don't want to hear anyone else complaining about the cost. If Hyundai's like, yeah, we could do that.
Well, I mean, we can't complain about Lotus. They're doing it.
That's true. Yeah, good job.
And Lucid went all the way to 900.
900. They're like, I'm going to see your 800. We're going to go to 9. So Lucid's like, this one goes to 11.
Yeah. So let's see. Does it say when this is going on sale? I'm not sure. One thing about this, it has three LiDAR sensors as part of its driver assist suite. And they are the first of what they're referring to as deployable LiDAR. So there's one in each front fender, just above the front wheel arches. Mm-hmm. And then another one above the windshield. And Lotus currently is owned by Geely, the Chinese automaker that also happens to own Volvo and Polestar and a whole bunch of other Chinese brands. And Volvo, of course, has a deal. They are using Luminar's Iris LiDAR. It's hard to tell, from the photos don't actually show the LiDAR, but the B-roll video that they supplied shows the LiDARs popping out from the sides when needed and from the top. And they kind of look like Luminar LiDAR, but we'll have to wait and see if that's what they actually are.
Mm-hmm. It's just, that Lucid had LiDAR on it. So we're seeing more and more actual cars with actual LiDAR coming out, being used, showing that having a redundant system is a good idea is essentially what it comes down to.
Yeah. You mentioned the 350 kilowatt charging. Lotus is claiming that this will deliver 248 miles of range in just 20 minutes on a 350 kilowatt charger.
If you can get it up that fast, that's the rub.
Yeah. It always is.
I've taken, there's a 350 near my house that I have to, all the 350s are like 30 miles, 40 miles from my house. So I have to yell at EA and tell them to put a 315 closer to me. Yeah, like I was there yesterday with a car and it was doing, the car was 240. Anyway, it was around 226 or something. It was doing pretty good. It was like up there, like within 3 kilowatts. Today it hit 200 for like a second. And then the rest of the time it was around 160. And I was just like, I'm on a 350. And I was like, come on.
Yeah, come that's on. This yesterday when I was at the BZ4X event, I was talking with a couple of people that work on charging experience for EVs at Toyota. And I spoke at some length complaining and saying, these are the things that you guys need to fix if you want EVs to be successful. You know, you've got to get whoever your charging network partners are to really make these things reliable, and you know, have the vehicle set up so that it can, so that it can charge as fast as it possibly can, and then also, make sure that the chargers are reliable. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of issues that need to be resolved with chargers, but that's one of the big ones, is making sure that when you plug it in, it charges fast.
Yeah, I mean, that's the killer app for Tesla still, is the charging network. Of course, Tesla only has to like know one system, and that's their own system. Once Tesla decides to open up, then all the issues you see with EA, with EVgo, with ChargePoint, where sometimes the software handshake doesn't work out so well, that's going to happen at Tesla, because every single car that comes out has to be taken to their, to whoever charging station. They have to figure out how it works. They got to tell the system, hey, this is a new car. This is how it charges. This is how big the battery is. This is how much power you got to send to it. It's just this whole, it's like trying to plug in a bunch of different, like, let's say hard drives into your MacBook or your PC. Yep. And it's just like every time there's like something a little bit different. And so it has to like reconfigure it.
All right. Let's see. Besides EVs, which we've been talking about at some length today, a lot of automakers have talked about by the end of this decade, at least here in North America, they're targeting getting to 50% of their sales being EVs. Ford has said this, GM has said this, Stellantis has said it, Volvo and others, want to be at least 50% EV sales in North America by the end of the decade. But of course, in a market where that's normally about 17 million vehicles in the U.S., if you're selling 50% EVs, that still means you got about 8.5 million sales a year with internal combustion engines. And the regulations for emissions and fuel economy for those engines is not getting any easier. And when you're the automaker that already ranks well at the bottom of the list for corporate average fuel economy, which is Stellantis, previously known as Fiat Chrysler. In 2020, their corporate average fuel economy was about 21.8 miles per gallon. And the next lowest one, I can't remember, I think it might have been GM or Ford, was like 23 plus. Stellantis, they want to sell half of their vehicles to be electric in 2030. But they've got to make their ICE vehicles more efficient, in the meantime. So they are launching what will in all likelihood maybe be their last ever all new internal combustion engine design. It's going on sale. It's actually in production now. It's going to be arriving in vehicles over the next few months. It's called Hurricane.
Hurricane.
It's a 3-liter inline twin turbo six cylinder engine. So no V6, which, this has been speculated for some time. And now it's real. And the standard output version is going to do over 400 horsepower, and 450 foot pounds of torque. And the high output version will be over 500 horsepower and 475 foot-pounds of torque, which, if those numbers sound remotely familiar, that is in the same ballpark as the current 5.7 and 6.4 liter Hemi V8s. So this thing is, in many applications, going to be replacing Hemi V8 engines over the course of the next year or so.
So instead of saying, I got a Hemi, people are going to be like, I got a Hurry. Hurricane.
Yeah.
That's what's going to be on the side of your cars, but everyone, sorry.
some interesting stuff on this engine. It's an all aluminum block, but because it's an inline six instead of a V6, you know, it's obviously longer than a V6 engine. But they wanted it to be able to fit in the same package volume where they currently have the V8 engines. So in order to reduce the spacing between the bores, they opted to not have iron or steel cylinder liners in there. Instead, they have what's known as plasma transfer wire arc coating or spray bore coating in there, which is something that was originally invented by Ford. But Ford was not actually the first company, the first automaker to put it into production. They didn't do it until 2010 on the GT500, when they went to an aluminum block on the GT500. The first company to use this in production was Nissan on the GTR. The GTR V6 uses this technology, which what it is, they have a steel wire that gets heated up to about 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit or 4,150 degrees Fahrenheit, and then blown, and when it's heated up that high, it blows, it creates microscopic particles of steel that are deposited onto the cylinder walls. So you have a really thin layer of steel covering that aluminum that is actually has 10 times the wear resistance of a cast iron liner, but it's a fraction of the thickness. So you can basically squish the whole engine down and fit it into the space of a V8.
And lighter.
And lighter, too.
Because cast iron is like, I don't know, like an ounce is like, what, 700-800 pounds?
Yeah. So this new six-cylinder, even though it's got, you know, twin turbos and intercoolers and everything on there, it still comes out to be about 65 pounds lighter than the corresponding V8 engines. So you got a lighter engine that's going to be about 15% more fuel efficient, make even a little bit more power, and it's coming to an assortment of Stellantis North American products only this year. It won't be used, so you won't see this in any next generation Alfa Romeo Giulias or Stelvios. It's not going to go into any products from Europe. It's only going to be used in North American products, although some of those are exported. They export Jeeps and other stuff overseas. But it's only going to be going into vehicles that are built here.
And in the vehicles you would anticipate.
Yeah.
You know, America likes a big engine and a big vehicle. That's what you're going to get. You need a Jeep? Yeah. You need a Dodge Ram? Yeah, you're going to get.
Yeah, they're not saying exactly which vehicles are getting it yet. I think it's pretty safe to assume that anything that's got a Hemi in it right now is a likely candidate for this thing.
For the Hurry.
Yeah.
I'm calling it now. It's going to be called the Hurry.
Hurry up.
Hurry. Or they might call it the Hemi. The Hemi Hurricane, so they can keep the name. Because Hemi's, I mean, that's a name you don't want to give up. Yeah. I'm sure there's going to be an EV Hemi. Like, oh, I got an EV Hemi in mine. I get the Hemi Electric or Hemi Plus or Hemi Ion or something. I don't know.
I don't know how they're going to figure that one out.
The Hemi, and the E will be blue. That's how they'll do it.
Oh,
just make the E blue. Hemi, yeah. Still a Hemi, but the E is blue.
Well, that's what they do on the 4xEs, on the Grand Cherokee 4xE. If you look at the badges, if you look closely at them, you'll see that it actually looks like it's two layers. You know, so you got the top layer is chrome, and then there's this like surf blue layer underneath, so that gives it that little distinct touch to separate it from the other ones.
Blue is the official color of electricity now.
Yeah, because apparently it is. Yeah, I mean the badges on that Toyota BZ4X,
blue.
It's all blue.
Everything's blue now.
Yeah. All right. The other stuff we have here, we need Nicole to talk about those. So we'll leave those aside for the time being. Let's dive into some questions. let's see. Let's start with Gupta AJ. He says, I'm not a tech bro. Can all the little computer chips in a vehicle be replaced by incorporating a PC in the vehicle? I mean, AMD, Intel, ARM chips don't seem to be in short supply.
They are. Everything's in short supply. I mean, it's you can the NVIDIA, the GPUs are, they're in short supply. Like, you know, crypto has not helped that situation at all. But yeah, all the chips are in short supply, unfortunately. You're missing a foundry's down, foundry's trying to catch up. They're trying to build foundries. Yeah.
They can't get enough neon from Ukraine.
Yeah, they can't get enough neon from the Ukraine. There's a lot of, yeah. All the little chips are just weird things that you probably don't ever think about that are in short supply that you wouldn't even assume are have to deal with cars. And you're just like, oh, well, the wiring harness from the Ukraine for the Volkswagen Group. That's just a weird thing. That's a thing.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not as simple as just dropping a PC into a vehicle. You know, first of all, the thermal requirements and the power requirements and the durability requirements for all this stuff in a car. You know, if you picked up your PC off your desk or picked up your laptop and stood there and shook it for a couple of hours, you know, and it just kept shaking it, and then, you know, cool it down to 40 below zero and heat it up to 120 Fahrenheit and repeat that process a couple of thousand times. And then, you know, expose it to salt spray and humidity and all that stuff. It probably wouldn't last very long.
Yeah. Yeah. Automotive grade is a huge, huge, huge thing that people don't really think about. They're like, well, we can build phones. I'm like, yeah, your phone's not automotive grade. If your phone crashes, like, no big deal.
Yeah. And, you know, to be fair, most of the processor chips that are in your car already are ARM chips of various types. You know, there's probably anywhere from 50 to 100 ARM chips in your car already if you have any kind of modern vehicle. You know, and it's, you know, a wide variety of ARM versions. You know, there's like older ARM 3, ARM 4, ARM 5 chips. There's ARM 7 stuff, and there's all kinds of things that are in there. And, you know, now we're getting GPUs put into cars as well. You know, that Lucid Air has got an NVIDIA SoC in there that they haven't said specifically which one, but I'm pretty sure it's the NVIDIA Xavier, which is a chip that combines like 8 ARM Cortex A57 cores, I think, and a whole bunch of NVIDIA Pascal GPU cores. And a bunch of other stuff all in one chip. The other problem with just putting a PC into your car is look at how many ports are on a typical modern PC. You know, you might have 2, 3, 4 USB ports of various types, maybe an HDMI, maybe an Ethernet port. That's about it. On a car, you've got, you know, hundreds of sensors that all need to be connected up. So you've got to have a lot of I/O, you know, connecting all this stuff that's monitoring everything and controlling all the systems in your car. So yeah, no, you can't just stick a PC in your car. It's not that simple.
Yeah, yeah. And then just writing all the software for every system on chip, and then making sure all that software talks to each other, and then having the software that like the people can use, and then making sure that it's, you know, it doesn't crash. Again, the not crashing part.
Yeah.
So not just like dying. Again, people are like, oh, well, you know, your phone. I'm like, your phone can, like, you know, if your phone just turns off, you're like, oh, okay. I've been in cars, like pre-production cars, where the car just turns off because the system crashed. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, oh, okay. This is what happens when, you know, things aren't quite ready.
I've been there.
Yeah.
I've been in many development vehicles when bad things happen with just the software. It's all, pew.
Everything's like, what happened? Car just turned off.
Yeah. And actually, you know, there are AMD and Intel chips in some cars already. You know,
Mobileye.
The refreshed Tesla Model S and Model X that were launched with the Plaid, the new infotainment system that's in those is using an AMD system on a chip that is basically the same chip that's in the latest
PlayStation,
Xbox, and PlayStation 5. So it combines an AMD x86 CPU and AMD GPU cores on one die. And Intel has been used for various things in vehicles for a long time. Not a huge amount of Intel stuff, but there's some in there. But it's mostly ARM
not
stuff.
Not as much as they should. I feel like Intel's really sort of like they're trying to get into. I mean, they've partnered with Ford and stuff, but you're just like Intel when it comes to mobile and vehicles. I feel like they. They're not pushing as much like NVIDIA. The last time I went to NVIDIA, they were building a brand new campus across the street because they had so much money.
Yeah. Well, back in the early 90s, Intel was supplying chips for the auto industry. You know, when I joined Kelsey Hayes in 1991, they were starting to work on the first applications with the ADC-196, which is basically a version of the chip that was in the original PC XT, but it was modified for automotive to make it automotive grade.
Mm-hmm.
Intel mostly dropped out of the auto industry later in the 90s when ARM chips came along, kind of like they did in mobile and other markets where they've been supplanted by ARM.
There was a dinner once I had with Intel, and me and another reporter, the person who was in charge of mobile at Intel, this is when Intel was still trying to get into phones, me and this other reporter just kept peppering this person with questions, like, well, why didn't you do this, and why didn't you do this, and the person just stopped talking to us, because it was just like, I feel bad, because we were just like, you know, we're reporters, that's our job, is to ask, like, a lot of questions, a lot of tough questions, and they're maybe a little, yeah. I think they just shut down because, you know, these were decisions not made by this person, essentially, is what it came down to.
Yeah.
And it's like, I felt bad, but again, it's my job and it was his job to answer him.
let's see. Next one from Andrew Pappas. How can dealers and manufacturers better educate salespeople? When I bought a Ford Focus, they didn't even know how to fold the rear seats flat. As cars grow exponentially in complexity, how will people learn to operate the car?
That's a weird thing because the automaker can send videos and training and do all these things, but it really comes down to the dealership itself, like making sure that the sales staff is watching this. And of course, I'm sure the sales staff is pushing back. Why am I watching this when I could be out on the floor making money?
Yeah,
and I think that's what it comes down to. If I'm not out on the floor, I'm not making money. If I'm sitting at my desk or I'm sitting in the back room and I'm watching a video about how things work for every single car that comes in, I'm wasting time because time is money. And I think that's kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah, you know, and another part of the problem as well is there tends to, you know, in sales staff, in automotive retail sales staff, there tends to be a lot of turnover. You know, people jump from one dealership to another, you know, often to different brands. And, you know, so they constantly have to learn new stuff. And, you know, they just want to focus on the basics, you know, get the basics sorted out. And, you know, I mean, you would think something like folding rear seats would be pretty basic. But, you know, it seems like, you know, every few years when it's time to go shop for a new car, you know, I am usually the one educating the salesperson as to what's in the car that they're trying to sell me. You know, explaining to him, you know, how these various features work. It's like,
Yeah, that happens. It's so frustrating. That happens with us, yeah. It comes down, I mean, fortunately, you can do a lot of research on your own for the vehicles that you are very interested in. So chances are, if you're spending time researching the vehicle that you really like, you're probably going to know more than the salesperson because you're only looking at one car. They're looking at all the cars plus all the used cars plus, you know, wherever they worked before plus their next job, which starts next week at Nissan, a Nissan dealership. And so, yeah.
Yep.
It's
all right.
Yeah.
Next one from Bryn Berenshausen asks, have any automakers looked into doing swappable or loanable batteries? not for in between every charge, but for temporary loans. You can buy a car with a reasonable but lower range and then rent an extended range battery for your annual road trip that gets swapped out. I know Mazda is doing a loaner vehicle program with the MX-30, but that's less than ideal for people who want to be able to stick with the car they bought instead of driving something they're unfamiliar with. It could be an interesting solution to battery cell availability. Not sure what the feasibility is for creating an ejectable battery, but I'm thinking dream scenario. So you're not going to have a quote-unquote ejectable battery, but if you go back to, what was it, 2014, I think, when Tesla demoed their battery swap system, that was exactly one of the selling points with that system was, you know, you could buy a Model S with, you know, the base level battery package, battery setup, you know, which would be more than enough for all of your daily commuting. And then, you know, for that weekly transcontinental road trip, you could go in and swap that out for the high capacity battery. And then when you get back, you get your original battery back. The problem there is more just battery swapping in general. Most manufacturers have shied away from battery swapping because it adds a lot of complexity. It adds potential failure modes, especially with liquid cooled batteries, because you've got to have not just electrical connections, but the coolant line connections. All this stuff's got to be flushed. It can be done. NIO does it in China. It's a big part of their business. They have something like 800 battery swap stations across China now. And you can go, but they don't have smaller and larger batteries. They just have one battery size.
You just swap it out.
Yeah. And this is another part of the problem. If you want to have multiple battery sizes, or, you know, if you've got different vehicles with different battery pack configurations, you know, over time, you know, you might, you know, as you design new generation vehicles, you might want to change the pack design. So now you've got to have swap stations that are stocking all these different kinds of batteries, and it starts to get really complicated really fast.
Yeah.
You know, if you're gonna stick with one format, it's great. But I think, you know, it's really going to be fleets more than anything else where you start to get some traction with battery swapping.
Yeah, there's a startup here in the Bay Area that has a battery swap for like people who are for fleets.
Ample?
And stuff. Yeah, Ample. So I went and watched it, and it took like 10 minutes or something. And instead of the entire pack, it pulls out little individual modules and then replaces the modules. But it works best for fleets. And I think what's the automakers, like, you know, a lot of these batteries are built into the frames, you know, it's part of the frame, and you're adding all this complexity, which means you're adding weight, which means the extra, you know, range you're going to get, you're going to lose on both ends, regardless of which battery pack you have. You're going to lose, you know, 10% of your range because you have all this extra weight because you're having to swap. You have to have this whole mechanism for swapping. And I think once everyone hits 800 kilowatt, an 800 volt system, and cars can charge at 300 kilowatts, then I think that's when you're going to have it's the idea of swapping batteries, because you're just going to pull up, charge really quickly, and then hopefully really quickly.
Yeah.
And then move on with your day.
All right. Hey, everybody, Nicole just locked in.
It did. Hello.
She just joined us.
Hello.
How was your flight, Nicole?
Longer than it was supposed to be, which is why I'm just joining now. Yes, we got a little bit delayed in our landing. So other than that, everything was peachy.
All right. Well, we have gone through a bunch of the stuff that we've been driving, and we also talked about the Lotus Eletre, that Lotus's new electric crossover, and Stellantis' new Hurricane engine. But tell us, what have you been driving?
The most recent thing that I had to drive was the 2022 Passport, the Honda Passport all-wheel drive trail sport, because everybody has to now have some kind of trail-worthy off-roady version of a car, or they're not even really making cars anymore. So I had that. And of course, the trim is orange, because also the color that you have to use it somewhere in your design is orange, or you'll call it bronze, or you'll call it rust. That's also the color of off-roading. So it is, but I'm right. That's true, right? Because if you look at them all, that's what they're all doing. So yes, I have that. It's got a 3.5 liter V6, a 9-speed automatic. It's a pretty responsive vehicle. They do, you know, it's got all the Honda sensing. It has, you know, the nice sort of interior. It's, I guess it's more like an upscale trim, but they also add some special stuff to it. There's a Trail Sport logo on the seats. And there's orange interior lighting. See, more orange. I'm not lying.
Orange.
And they get gray wheels and sort of, it's like trim stuff that makes it look a little bit fancy pants.
So it looks more rugged.
It looks more rugged. Orange is rugged. I mean, like yellow, not rugged. Orange, yeah, let's climb a mountain.
Orange is rugged because it's the sunset, it's clay, it's sedimentary rock, it's all those things.
Sedimentary rock. Well, I hadn't thought of that necessarily, but now I will pumpkins, think of sedimentary rock.
Sometimes you're driving through a field and there's a bunch of pumpkins, just drive right over them.
And then because you're so rugged and the orange just compels you to be more rugged.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So it is $44,090. So it's, you know, not an inexpensive vehicle, but it's, you get that, you know,
is there
Honda
such
quality.
A thing anymore?
No, there's not. You know, weirdly, I was looking something up the other day. Okay, the first ever drive program that I ever did was for the Dodge Dart almost 10 years ago to the day when they were launching that. And I was looking at the pricing on that. And I'm like, was that only 10 years ago? Because I don't think you could buy a scooter for that price at this point. So everything's expensive.
Going back to rugged orange for a moment. Either of you watched Murderville yet?
No.
I've watched a couple episodes. I watched the one with the football player guy.
Yeah, I think that was the second
episode. Oh, he is so good. They should just have him in everything.
Yeah.
And then I think I watched the Sharon Stone one. I've watched a couple of them. I really like it.
So for those not familiar with Murderville, it's Netflix or Amazon?
Netflix.
Prime? Netflix. It's a new show that's on Netflix. Stars Will Arnett as a homicide detective, senior detective. And each episode he's paired with a different celebrity trainee detective. The first episode was
I didn't
was
know what
Conan,
it was called.
Yeah,
my husband
Conan O'Brien.
Was like all into it. I had no idea what it's called. I've seen a bunch of episodes.
Well, the reason I bring this up, you talked about orange being the color of rugged.
Yes.
The vehicle that Will Arnett drives, his thing that he drives around every day, is an orange Dodge Rampage.
Oh, that's awesome.
I saw a Rampage like a few weeks ago at Home Depot, and I was like, oh my God, I haven't seen one of these.
And then
I watched Murderville. I'm like, oh my God, Will Arnett has an orange
there
Rampage.
There it is.
Yeah, we were watching that. My wife was looking at that. What the hell is that? And I had to explain to her what it was.
See, once upon a time.
Yeah. So for those of you that are a little younger, the Rampage was Dodge's answer to the VW Rabbit pickup in the early 80s. It was a compact pickup based on the Dodge Omni 024. So it was their little subcompact hatchback with a pickup bed, or what Australians would call a ute.
A ute.
Yeah. Kind of a mini El Camino.
Yeah, that's a good description. A mini El Camino. Like if you're like, oh, I like El Camino, but I want it smaller.
Yeah.
And rugged because that one's orange.
Exactly.
And rugged.
It's clearly the more rugged version. All right. Anything else on the Passport?
No, I mean, it's a neat trim level, and I mean, it's cool, and it's funny. They have the commercials for it. So here's the funny thing. They're running a lot of ads on TV for this right now, and you see the ads, and it's being all rugged, and it goes through – like it's all off road. And my daughter's like, how, you know, could we do this off road trail? I'm like, not really. Like this trail by our house. I'm like, no, I don't think so. She's like, but the commercial lies. I'm like, no, the commercial has the car driving through a rather deep mud puddle on a perfectly level stretch of very dusty dirt road and through a little bit of mud. It does not have it climbing over rocks. So the commercial is spot on.
Well, to be fair, when Honda launched the Passport a couple of years ago,
yes,
they did the launch drive program out in Moab,
mm-hmm.
and we did crawl over some rocks.
stuff.
They weren't quite as big as the rocks that we crawled over with the Grand Cherokee last week.
You're saying this to me that it's off-roady and crawled over rocks right after I did a Jeep program, and those guys try to flip you upside down. But so I don't.
There are levels of rocks.
There are levels of rocks.
I mean, they were bigger than pebbles, but smaller than these ginormous
smaller than Jeep rocks
we saw in Texas.
Yeah,
that should be the bar by which you said when you say you drove over rocks, Jeep level rocks or like you know Honda level rocks. What did you drive over?
to be completely fair, I've been to a lot. Whenever I get these off road cars, I take them to an off road park. There's never anybody there in anything. There's some 4Runners. There's some Jeeps. There's a lot of 4Runners. There's a lot of 4Runners and some Jeeps. That's essentially all these, you know, 4Runners and Jeeps. I saw one Bronco. It was brand new and clean, and the person was very careful.
Because
it's new and brand new. Yeah.
No, until you get that first, they just have to just go out there and scratch the bejesus out of it on a tree branch or something. Then they'll be all fine.
Until you have some paint damage and you hear that steel skid plate scraping over the boulders, you're not doing it right.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
And we definitely heard that last week, but we can't talk about that until
we can't talk about how it drove. Yeah, we have 2 more weeks. We can't say how it drove. We can just say we drove it off road. I know. April 19th. It was a long embargo.
I've had one for a month. Ugh, crazy.
All right. Let's stick with SUVs or sort of pseudo SUVs. Tell us about the Mazda CX-50.
Who, me?
Yeah, you're the only one who drove it.
I'm the one who drove it. So the Mazda
I can tell you about it. It's not gonna, and none of it's going to be like helpful.
invent something about the CX-50. Okay, and I literally, guys, remember I just like walked into a hotel room, so I have nothing open in front of me, so I can give you no facts and figures. So, but as far as driving it, so they're billing the CX-50 is a little bit different as something. Again, we should have levels here. It's a little more rugged and off-road worthy, not Jeep. Off-road, Mazda off-road. But they have drive modes on this. So you have a sport, you have an off-road, and then if you are in select trims, you also have a towing mode. It doesn't tow a whole ton, but I think I want to say it's 3,500 pounds. I could be making that up.
It's almost 2 tons.
Yeah, that's almost 2 tons.
That's 2 tons.
Yeah, you're kind of opening yourself up for that. We're sorry.
Whatever. You know,
it's like a ton and a half.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning.
A ton and three quarters.
But so they did have us drive off road, which is kind of like this, like breaks your head a little bit because you're like, Mazda, what happened to my little Miata? Like now I'm taking it in the dirt. And it was like, it's not something you're really going to do anything rugged off-roading in, but it took you into the dirt. We went up some sort of grassy, dirt-ish hills that, you know, there were some little pothole-y situations there that they made it so it was a little bit more challenging. They had us do a not super high speed, but driving a little bit faster, sort of on a loop on this dirt area so that we could get a feel for it. And can you off-road in it? Very lightly, yes. Is it a more capable Mazda if you're going to drive in the dirt than other Mazdas? Definitely. I mean, they did change how the torque distributes between the wheels. So it's not like they have these drive modes that do, when you push that off-road button, it adjusts 15 different systems within the vehicle. It just really pretty much just adjusts how the torque is distributed to try to keep your wheels from slipping and keep the traction where you're going to want it when you have maybe one wheel popped in the air a little bit because you're on uneven terrain. I don't know how many people are going to pop one wheel in the air in a Mazda, but if you did...
can it handle Honda rocks? I mean, obviously, I don't think they're like Jeep rocks.
I feel like it could not handle Jeep rocks. I feel like it could have handled. I don't feel like it could handle really rocks. It could handle Honda dirt. It could handle Honda mud. It could handle Honda very tall grass. I don't want to say it's just so hard because literally I did these like that back to back with Jeep, and it's not really an off-road vehicle, but if you're going to be driving on stuff that's a little bit more rugged, maybe you want to drive right to, you know, off-road to your cabin or to the lake house, or you're getting out there because you're mountain biking or something and you want to be able to drive a little bit off the beaten path, but there's still maybe a little path. then you're okay. And it still does all that and delivers the sort of Mazda experience. It's a premium vehicle. They said, how do they say it? They said they were pushing towards, they didn't say being a luxury brand. I believe they said a premium brand. And when they were put on the spot about it, they said, you know, like, wait, are you sort of saying you are not just a regular run of the mill, you know, automaker? You're really trying to go towards luxury. And they're like, premium brand. Yes, we are pushing to that, but we are not forgetting that not everybody who buys a Mazda is looking for what would have been like their signature trim in most of their lineup. Not everybody wants the leather seats and the really wood trims and the fancy interiors. Like, they're going to remember that there's still a range of customers who buy Mazdas, so they're not going to like shut out people who are buying base trims. And they had, I just forgot the name of it, Meridian? They have a
top... The audio system?
No, it's not the audio system. It's the top. They have a trim that's like the off. It gets a package like the Trail Sport. There's like one that has more of like an off-roady kind of look to it. They did not have that one there for us to drive, unfortunately. But that one,
yeah, Meridian Edition. So you're right.
It is Meridian. Okay, yes. That's what I thought. So the Meridian Edition, and they, which is going to, I think, be mostly about looks. I don't know how much actual content there is to make that one any better. But that one was something that we didn't have, unfortunately. We did not have that one to try out, which was like, wah, wah, we're on an off-road thing. Give us that one. But it also has late arrival, and they didn't have pricing on it. So it's kind of a little bit of a question mark as to when and how much it'll cost. And yeah, so that one's sort of like a little mystery that we'll have to wait to reveal in the coming months.
Okay. So while we're still with CX-50, one of the questions we had from Bryn Berenshausen was related to CX-50. He tweeted and retweeted a video that a Canadian journalist, I think, posted in the CX-50, a TikTok video. Apparently, the CX-50 now has a touchscreen.
Yes. Okay, that's a big deal. And here's the weirdness. So they're going through the thing and they're like talking about it. And like, yeah, and, you know, and the touchscreen that works. And we're all just like, wait, I'm sorry, what? Touchscreen? Did we just hear those words come out of your mouth? Your Mazda, right? It's a touchscreen, but only when you're using Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, and only if you enable the touchscreen in the settings. So only when you're using those apps. If you leave that native app, no touchscreen. And they said the reason they did it was because both of those apps are optimized for touchscreen. The way that the buttons are arranged and the sizes of the buttons and the style of it, it doesn't work as well with their rotary dial controller. And I thought, my first thought honestly was, huzzah, some touchscreen functionality in a Mazda. But oddly, it's almost more confusing now because you have that moment of like, you'll go to touch it then and you're no longer using that. It's like, wait, no. You don't know what to do. Like, do
you got mode confusion?
Yeah, you're like, I don't know which direction to go. So it works beautifully. I mean, it does do what it's supposed to do. You can now use that as a touchscreen using those two, you know, Apple CarPlay or Android Auto. But it does make you a little bit confused. Your brain's like, what? Wait, no, this is not that. I have to reach, where's the controller? So it's a good happy medium, but also one that causes a little additional confusion.
So, well, Bryn's question was, are they going to put that in all Mazdas, or is it just the CX-50 right now?
I can't remember if that question was directly asked. Something tells me that I felt like it was something that may have been rolling out, but I can't confirm that for sure. I would imagine.
I'll reach out to Mazda and ask them.
I'm sorry, I don't have that at the ready. Sorry, Bryn.
No worries. Another thing that you and I both drove last episode I put together, we had our segment where we talked about the C40, but we never did. We forgot to talk about the XC60 recharge that we drove the day before the C40.
Yes.
So the XC60, you know, has been around for a while, and they've had the plug-in hybrid recharge for 2022. They've upgraded it with more battery capacity and a more powerful electric motor on the rear axle. It's up to 147 horsepower. And so now the range has gone, the electric driving range has gone from 19 to 35 miles on the EPA test. What did you think of the XC60?
I mean, we had a really brief drive in it. It wasn't very long that we had. It was sort of like when we landed at the airport, it kind of like a little loop-de-loop and back again. I thought it was, I didn't notice this gigantic difference. You know, I don't think to me, I liked it before. I liked it now, but I didn't walk away thinking, oh, wow, now it's like way cooler.
I feel like the XC60, like the XC90 is great. The XC40 is great. The XC60 was just sort of good. And I think they've tweaked it enough where it's better. I don't think it's on the level as the 90 or the 40 yet, but it's like the best selling one. So it's like they these really great ones, and then they have a good one. But the good one's the one they sell a lot of. We got lost around the airport in Belgium when that the XC60.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, with the recharge.
Yeah, I think to me, I think that the 60 series is more it's the sweet spot for me. It's the right size. I find the 90s. I like the 90s, but I find them to be a little too big. And bigger than I would want for myself.
Yeah.
The 40s will, it's a good size too, but I like the size of the 60s. My personal favorite is the V60 wagon. But
V60 wagon is dope.
Yeah. I've driven the XC60 plug-in hybrid before, but never driving it up any mountains. And we did that with this one. We drove from Palm Springs up to the Coachella Valley Vista Point. Mm-hmm. It had no problem at all, with 147 horsepower on the rear axle. It had plenty of power for driving pure electric, up the mountain, going through the curves and everything. And that's like 50 horsepower more than it had before from the electric motor. So I thought that was good. But one of the questions that we had from Daryl on Twitter. Says, why can't cloth be a good option in luxury vehicles? It's popular on performance vehicles. I'd much rather have a nice patterned cloth than base leather or whatever tech substitute. And so I thought this was a good fit here because one of the new features on the XC60 for 2022 is this new wool cloth upholstery that they have on the seats. Did you drive one with the wool or the leather?
I can't remember if I drove it or just ended up looking at it, but I saw the material that you're talking about, and I actually really like it. I think it looks great. Like from a point of view of like, oh, you have to have leather or some kind of fancy schmancy synthetic leather for it to be luxury. I think it just needs to be something that has some character and has some personality to it and just doesn't look like really super cheap fabric. And that wool is actually kind of cool looking.
Yeah. I mean, if it was me, I'd probably choose the wool. I liked the way it felt and the way it looked. It was a lighter gray wool that they had in there. I probably wouldn't go with the wool if I had young kids or I was hauling the dog around in there.
That's why I wouldn't go with the fabric interior, because if you spill something, even your coffee, if you're a grown up and have no kids, you spill it on fabric, no matter how dark it is, it does get into the fabric. You spill it on synthetic leather or leather, you can probably wipe it off and save it. You know what I mean? It's you can clean it. You can't. Cleaning fabric seats is a pain in the butt.
Yeah. So the answer to Daryl's question is cloth can be a good option in luxury vehicles. It's available in some. It's out there. You just got to find it. You just got to find the right vehicles. All right, let's finish up the last few questions here. Let's see, we talked about the Mazda touchscreens. We talked about the battery swapping. Fridolin Coke. Hopefully I'm not mangling that too much. Says, have you ever seen or driven an Audi A2 or an NSU RO80 in the U.S.? I think both cars were really ahead of their time, but not a success commercially. Automakers nowadays don't seem to be willing to take such risks anymore. So the NSU RO80 was from the 60s, I think. NSU was one of the brands that got folded into Audi. And the RO80 was a rotary-powered car that they had back in the 60s. And the A2 was, I think, 90s, early 2000s, a subcompact Audi, had an aluminum space frame, very lightweight. Have either of you ever driven any of those?
That'd be a no from me. Nope.
No, sadly no.
Yeah, I have not either. The A2 was never brought over here. I think there are some NSUs in the U.S. I don't know that they were ever imported, officially imported, but you know, obviously people have brought them over, and I've seen some NSUs at car shows, but I've never driven either one of these.
I think in a couple of years we'll be able to get some A2s over here because the 25-year thing. But you know, Americans, it's weird with small cars in America. Like, well, no one buys small cars, and then there's the Mini, and that did really well. And you're just like, all right.
David Wengier, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that as well, says, talk me out of a Ford Escape PHEV. Is EV only mode 99% of the time possible, or will it feel underpowered? Will it start the gas engine occasionally to keep things from deteriorating? We do one or two road trips a year, but other than that, trips are less than 20 miles a day.
Okay, so I've said this before. The Ford Escape is like Applebee's. It's the Applebee's of cars. Like, I don't know anyone who's like, yeah, let's go to Applebee's. It's just like, oh, well, there's an Applebee's. It's not going to make you sick. It's food. The Ford Escape PHEV is...
You might want to watch out for the salad, though.
You should never get a salad from, like, a chain restaurant also.
Nope.
That's always a bad scene. But the Ford Escape PHEV, it's fine. It's just sort of there. It drives well. It's okay. I will say that, like, when I drove the PHEV, after hours behind the wheel, my back kind of hurts.
Really?
Yeah. It gave me back pain.
Well, that's not good.
Yeah, but that is me. You should drive the vehicle and see how you feel.
Yes.
Everybody's body's different.
I have long legs and a weird, long torso. And
in case I have
like really long arms. I'm essentially like a spider when you really think about it. So there's that. But I don't want to talk you out of buying a PHEV if you can get one now.
I don't think I could talk someone. I wouldn't talk
it's
you
not
out
horrible,
of it.
It's not a horrible car. It drives well. The transition from EV to gas is fine. It's just sort of, again, it's the Applebee's of cars. You're not going to get sick at Applebee's.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's food there.
To answer the basic question, if you're driving less than 20 miles a day, you can do 99% of your driving on electricity alone.
Yeah.
You can get, I got 42 miles on electricity on my usual EV drive loop. It's not going to be hugely powerful, but it's more than adequate for daily driving, especially around town. Town driving, you'll have more than enough torque because there's not a lot of power, but there's plenty of torque from the electric motor.
It's fine. That's what that's. Ford Escape PHEV. It's fine. You're not going to be like super disappointed that you bought the Ford Escape.
No,
PHEV.
That's just it. It's like, and if you don't drive that much and you don't care about it, like if you don't mind Applebee's, I mean, you'll be okay. If you don't want Applebee's, don't go to Applebee's. But I don't think I can talk you out of Applebee's if that's what you're considering. I can't hate on it.
Yeah,
I mean, I could hate on Applebee's, but still, I couldn't hate on the Ford PHEV.
Yeah, it's not a bad car. It's just it's fine.
Yeah. It's fine.
Any plug-in hybrid will periodically run the engine, just to cycle fluids, keep things from deteriorating. And also to consume the gas in the tank. In general, most of them are designed, to run a maintenance mode that will consume, the volume of gasoline in the tank over the course of about a year.
Yeah.
You don't want to leave gas sitting in the tank.
You don't want old gas.
Yeah.
My brother's Chevy Volt with a V, because during COVID and lockdown and everything, he wasn't driving anywhere. And at one point, the car was just like, you know what? We're going all gas because all your gas is old.
That's funny.
You haven't driven enough, so we're going to run this gas out before you get to go back to EV mode.
All right. Mike Enos asks, any recommendations or best practices for charging an EV at home other than finding a licensed electrician? So, yes, absolutely get a licensed electrician. Do not do this on your own.
Don't do it yourself.
Unless, of course, you happen to be a licensed electrician, in which case, have at it.
Yes.
Any other recommendations? Robbie, you're the EV owner.
Yeah, I just had this done, actually. I called a licensed electrician. They came out, and they put it in. And then yesterday, the city came out, and they inspected it and made sure that my house won't burn down. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that is definitely – I know it's going to – it costs more because you get a licensed electrician, and it's going to cost you more money. You know, there was like $400 just for them to do all the drawings and the wirings and all the permitting and then to be here at my house when the person shows up. And I was just like, all right, yeah, so my house won't burn down. And they're bonded and licensed and all that jazz. So if, you know, things go haywire, yeah, it's when it comes to your house and wiring, like, I don't want my house to burn down. That's where, yeah.
Nobody
someone
wants
if
that.
I know I have a guy who will build my fence, and I have a guy who would do the landscaping, and I have a guy who like trim the trees, and I'm just like, yeah, that's fine. But I like when it comes down to like those guys could do the wiring, but no.
We got our plug-in. We hired an electrician. He came out. He put a charger in the house. He did the permits. We paid him money. House not burning down. It was worth it.
Thumbs up to a house
thumbs
still
up.
Standing.
Do you both have your chargers inside the garage or on the outside of the house?
Mine is on the outside just because we do, you know, I get a lot of review vehicles. We park the cars outside. I keep buying tools. I have every saw now. You need a saw, you come to my, you need something cut, I got a table saw, I got a circular saw, I got a jigsaw, I got all the saws now. So because of that, I got, you know, the miter saw, I got everything. They take up a lot of space in the garage. So before we were like, oh, we're just going to move this stuff and then we'll eventually put the car in the garage. And now it's just like, eh, we've become the people who are just, the garage is now just the project land and the cars are parked outside. But we can put three cars in our driveway.
We put ours in the garage just because, I mean, normally it's honestly the car's parked outside and the cable just goes outside the garage because we've got a really long cable for it, or like cords so we can plug it in. But if it snows, because I'm in New England, I don't want to have to leave the car outside and clean off the car when you get those like weird dumping snowstorms. Then I can definitely park it inside. So it was mostly for that, just so that in the winter, like I really hate clearing snow off a car in the winter, and I want to be able to park in the garage. So
yeah, if I lived in snow, I would definitely do that. But
I have a licensed electrician coming on Monday to install a 240 volt outlet in my garage.
There you go.
And I'm putting it on the inside, just inside the garage door, that when I have
run it out.
Plug in vehicles to test, yeah, I'll just run the cord outside to the driveway. And then someday in the future, when you know, when we have an EV of our own. Then, you know, I'll have it in the garage. But one, you know, as far as other best practices, you know, just in terms of actually charging your EV, take advantage of, you know, the fact that you can, you know, pretty much every EV I've ever seen, you can schedule when you want it to charge, so that you can take advantage of low interest or low off-peak electricity rates, you know, usually after like, you know, 9 or 10 o'clock at night, you know, until early morning. You know, so cost you less. In some cases, depending on where you are, you may want to consider, you know, check with your local utility. It may be worthwhile for you to get a separate meter installed for your charger, because sometimes they have special rates, special electricity rates for EVs. But to take advantage of that, you've got to have a dedicated meter for that outlet that where you're charging the EV, and that can save you quite a bit of money as well. And then, you know, when you use the scheduling, you know, when you get home, you just plug in the car, and you don't have to, you know, plan when it's going to charge. It'll just, you know,
it'll just
plug
turn
it
on.
In and it'll start charging at whatever time it's set.
Yeah. I'm reviewing three charge boxes right now. I'm doing the juice box, the one from, Electrify America, and the charge point box. And, on those, what you do is you schedule it within the box. And then you have a little app, and it tells you like when it starts charging, and it's pretty nice. And yeah, we also set up a tier. Our rate is based on having an EV. We had to put our VIN number. We had to give our utility the VIN number and everything.
Mm.
So yeah, so at midnight, from midnight to like noon, is like the least expensive. And so we just plug the car in, but you know, most of the time the car's charged. My wife will plug it in, and then 20 minutes later it's charged. Because we're pushing about 9 kilowatts now per hour.
Finally, Brianna Wu asks, do you think Ferrari prices will ever come back to earth, or is today the best price I'll ever see on one?
I think everything's going to come down. I mean, it's
eventually.
It's a boom market, and at some point,
every bubble eventually bursts.
And I feel like, you know, a friend of mine was like looking at a Bronco, and I'm like, you have a car, you don't need a car, wait 2 years.
Right.
Right now, everything is incredibly inflated. If you're going to sell a car, man, you should be selling that thing now.
Right.
If you are going to buy a car.
Assuming you don't actually need it to get around.
Yeah, as long as you don't need it to get around.
If you have an extra one,
just lying
just
about.
Just chilling in the garage,
just
hanging out.
In the garage, you could sell it. If you're going to, now, like, buying anything, if you can help it, don't. I think the Ferrari prices will probably come back down at some point. I think
they'll probably never be cheap. But
yeah, it's never going to be cheap. It's like 9/11 prices. I think 9/11 prices are going to come back down, but it's still going to cost a 9/11. It's still a 9/11. You know,
it will be less than what it is now, but it's still not going to be the price of a Prius.
Yeah, eventually people will stop paying $120,000 for Acura Integras.
Exactly. We'll be able to get an Acura Integra for a lot less money. Hope. I think someone was showing off like Model A's and stuff, like hot rods, and like the prices on those are just like cratering because no one wants them anymore. Because that generation that liked those cars are just like, now they're in their 70s and 80s. They're like, well, I'm not going to go buy a project car. I'm not even buying green bananas right now. Why would I buy a project car?
Don't want to wait around for them to ripen.
Yeah. So, and then like everyone, like the Gen X people who are buying up all the Radwood stuff for insane amounts of money.
Yeah.
You know, we'll get older and then you'll be
the $120,000 Integra.
Yeah, exactly. Like once I'm in my 70s, you'll be able to get a CRX for like $20,000 or $15,000 again. some ridiculously cheap, $5,000 for a CRX.
All right. Well, that's all we've got for this week. Thanks for hopping in there, Nicole.
Yeah, sure.
And we will talk to you all next time.
Bye.
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 Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.